Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I had a thing called Bang Bang Cauliflower, which took me a week to recover from. I was delirious for a week. And just like, felt like I'd taken acid. It was so weird.
Britain, an ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are the General Witchfinders.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, welcome back. We're back with the 36th episode, somehow, of the General Witchfinders podcast. I'm James in Bournemouth in Southern England.
Is it me now?
It is you, yes.
I'm Tom Pountney in South of Wales, which is still in the South of... It's in Wales, it's in the South of Wales, it's wherever you want it to be. It's part of your own psyche as a listener.
Yeah, Wales is more a state of mind rather than... Yeah. And I'm Ross in Dorchester in Southern England. This time we met the woman in black.
You know the Drablow estate? Mr. Drablow was a China trader. He died out east. Now his widow has just passed away.
I want you to attend the funeral.
You're to stay on and clear things up. Sort out Mrs. Drablow's effects and any documents. And put the house up for sale.
Found ways to make me hear their calamity in the marshes. Last night,
so tonight we are discussing the 1989 British horror drama television film, directed by Herbert Wise, most famous for I, Claudius, or I, Clavdivs, who worked solidly from 1957 to 2001 on everything from generic ICV crime drama The Bill to 9 episodes of Tales of the Unexpected, including The Landlady, which may well be the episode that John talks about remembering in episode 29, which I can't
Good remember. God.
The one, is that?
The one where the woman stuffs the people who come to stay in her house.
Absolutely terrifying. The peak terrifying moment of my entire childhood up to my... I don't know when I've been more scared.
I don't know if you've ever recovered from it, John.
Go on, yeah, carry on, James.
All right, okay. Well, and also, I've got to, once again, this is one of these things, but I've got to take umbrage with Ross's script coming up here. Right, so it stars, the protagonist is Adrian Rawlins, and Ross has put Harry Potter's dead dad in the movies and Mr. Pike in one episode of Neighbours. But Hold that thought, Ross, because I was amazed when I figured out that he's Nikolai Fomin in Chernobyl.
Oh, okay.
Chernobyl,
one of the great things of the last sort of 10, 15 years on TV.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
That was the next thing after Neighbours, but, you know.
Absolutely. So, yeah, he's in that. He's one of the sort of the lead engineers of Chernobyl, and they all sort of try and blame each other for the disaster. So he's in that.
Did I tell you about when we was using like the voice activated thing on our telly, and it didn't recognise what I was saying when I was asked to play Chernobyl? I kept saying play Chernobyl, and it would go, and it would say shut up, and it just goes and shut up, and I tried to do it slowly. I went Chernobyl, and it went shut up poo.
The artificial intelligence revolution is underway, yeah. Everybody. And then also, after that, most recently with me putting my inevitable Star Wars hat back on, he was in the sort of the best episodes of Andor.
Okay.
He's the doctor in the prison looking exactly like he did, the glasses and everything, in Chernobyl. And he is sort of like the doctor who tells them what's really going on. And so recently, despite the fact that he was Mr. Pike in one episode of Neighbours, he's had a recent kind of
resurgent.
Late career resurgence. Absolutely. So I thought,
and he's also in the modern day sequel to Woman in Black as well.
Oh, okay.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it worth pointing out that, of course, he plays the father of Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
who is the star of 2012's Woman in Black,
yes.
Hammer Films reboot.
Yes.
Yes.
Everyone will realise that that's listening, but I didn't know that until I read the Wikipedia earlier, and I thought that's interesting.
So it says, but it also stars Bernard Hepson, who was in I, Claudius, mm-hmm. Get Carter, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, I'm assuming the TV version,
yep.
and Colditz, David Dacre, who was in 93 episodes of Boone with Michael Elphick. Howl Silver! You got me, Lord Ranger. Anyway, so 84 episodes of Zed Cars, Time Bandits, and two Doctor Who stories for our Whovian friends. Iron Gron in The Time Warrior, yeah. and Captain Rig in Nightmare of Eden. That means nothing.
Oh,
you'll
lovely.
Have to tell me what that means.
It's a John Pertwee story and a Tom Baker story.
Lovely. Right.
I wouldn't say it's not one of Tom Baker's finest moments. Strong.
he's had many moments, I imagine, over his life, which were particularly fine.
Oh, come on, the man.
Yeah.
It's a legend, right? Anyway, and Pauline Moran, who was Miss Lemon in many episodes of Poirot, and according to Ross, was bass player in the all-female band, the She Trinity, who had a top 40 hit cover of He Fought the Law in 1966. Who knew? So, Hills, the Woman in Black, had already been adapted into a beloved stage play that went on to become the West End in London's second longest running non-musical after The Mousetrap.
No way.
Yeah. More recently, the story was filmed, as John's just mentioned, by Hammer when Hammer kind of was born again. Mm. Has it again died? Has it gone again?
They released a few little odds and sods. Something called, I think, Witchwood.
Yeah.
Which was W-Y-C-H Wood, yeah. and then I'm not sure.
Mm.
They did do Woman in Black 2.
Yes.
Bigger and Blacker or something.
That's right.
But I'm not sure. Helen and I went to see that, and I did actually really like it. So that one was set in the Second World War. It was total cobblers, but it was a bit of a hoot.
Interesting. I'm going to...
Well, they got a film coming out called The Lodge, which is coming out soon.
Okay, well, there you go. Yeah. That's me told. Thank you.
Mm.
Right, and then, as I said, so more recently, the story was filmed by Hammer Studios in 2012, starring Daniel Radcliffe and going on to be
unbelievably, although I did see it, I saw this in the cinema, so it shouldn't be that unbelievable that I bothered to go and see it. It went on to be the highest grossing British horror movie of all time.
Good God.
Yeah, right? This teleplay is adapted from the 1983 novella of the same name by Susan Hill. It focuses on a young solicitor who is sent to a coastal English village to settle the estate of a reclusive widow and finds the town haunted.
I had no idea it was such a modern novel. I thought it was really old, yeah.
Because
she's from Scarborough, the author.
Yes. I was going to say that to you, John. Of course, John knew that already. Right, so the programme was produced by Central Independent Television for ITV.
Yes.
Yeah. And it was filmed at Stanlake Park in Berkshire and using the causeway to OC Island near Goldhanger in Essex. Now, pause on that one as well, Ross.
Not in the Midlands
I saw that
at
because
all.
They've used that recently. Are you familiar with The Third Day? I think this is something that we might look at. It had Jude Law in it.
No. Oh, okay.
And it was done for Sky. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very sort of folk horror heavy. Mm-hmm. And the whole point is it takes place on OC Island.
Okay.
And the whole thing of it being cut off by the tides, and thus all weird things go on.
Is this similar to Mersey Island? Where's Mersey Island?
I'm not sure.
It's not on the Mersey. Okay, I'll look that up now.
But yeah, so the third day could go. I know our list goes on for about 5 weeks, the things we're going to look at, but that could be a potential one for us in the future because that's a really good sort of folk horror.
Okay.
So OC Island, not the first time it's
Mersey Island is in Essex, so maybe it's a similar place, but that is somewhere you also can't get to at certain times of day because of the tide. I have to pull my glasses down like this now because
I was just looking at that. That's a good look for you, John.
Well, it reminds me of Jim Kirk at the end of Star Trek 2 when he has to put his reading specs on. But he doesn't go quite as cross-eyed as me when
part of that time loop, isn't it? Because he goes back in time, sells the glasses, which then end up coming back to him.
Is that true?
What?
Yeah.
Because, when does that happen, Ross?
Because he has to sell
four.
He sells the glasses in four in order to make some money because they don't have any cash. But then he gets given them as a gift in Star Trek 3.
I haven't seen four in so long.
It was on the other day. And the motion picture was on the other day. And the one with the Borg was on the other day. So I was like, God, these are... But then the J.J. Abrams Star Trek was on last night. Mm-hmm. And I said to Hel, when they cast the original Star Trek, they got so lucky with all of the actors because the J.J. Abrams ones are rubbish because all of the actors are fucking useless. Chris Pine useless. Mr. Spock is awful.
Well, I can't believe they cast so many Spocks over time.
Ridiculous.
Yeah.
And Scotty, also, awful. Simon Pegg's
terrible. Well, I was going to say, don't say that to Simon Pegg because that one time that he turned up at a Star Trek convention and they did a... thing with people there, didn't they, saying vote for your favorite Star Trek films of all time, and he went absolutely mental when they put his ones at the bottom. And then it was all like, oh no, don't be mean to him, everyone, he's an alcoholic. I'm like, I think an alcoholic with a very thin skin, some of the things.
But did you know the original version of Star Trek 4 was meant to be an Eddie Murphy vehicle?
Yes it is. Because Eddie Murphy's a big Trek fan and was very keen to do it. And it's all part of his deal with Paramount. Yeah. But the option was either that or the Make the Golden Child instead. And he went for the Golden Child.
Imagine
Anywho.
That.
Scared the shit out of
him. How would he face off against the charisma of the Trek team? The original... Motion Pictures on the other day, and I was like, how handsome is William Shatner? I was like, oh my God, he looks amazing in this film. He carries the whole film. Just by reaction shots of models of the Starship Enterprise that he can't even see.
It is 98% reaction shots to models. This is going to have a really slow trip in the ship alongside it. Did look good, but it went on for
a while.
This might be a cut out, but I think you'll both probably enjoy this story, Ross, you might know it already. But there's a really good series on Amazon, which is one of those ones where you can watch it, but there's ads on it. But it's only like one ad per the half hour. And it's kind of like, it's the history of Trek. And during lockdown, I watched it, of course, because we had a time on our hands. And there was an amazing bit where they were talking about making Wrath of Khan. And they said, like Nicholas Meyer was like, during the part where he went, when he sends over the code to Khan and he says, here it comes. He says, Shatner could not stop having it up. And like every time he went, here it comes. Here it comes.
And I think he's got his glasses on at that point. That's right.
And it's apparently Nicholas Meyer said, I took him to one side and said, look, Bill, I don't think he'd respond like this. It's a life and death situation. I think he'd be more serious. And Shatner was like, I don't think so. So he realized the only way to do it was he made him do it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So he said, so that final take where he was really fucked off, he's like, yeah. Here it comes. He's like, that's the last take. That's the one that we used. Yeah. He just had to wear also, down Shatner.
They're making such a big deal about them being old in the Star Trek films. And then you see Picard, where you got Patrick Stewart, like basically 100 years old. Yeah. And he's still having sex.
But it's just thin.
Yeah.
Like, I was looking at stills from the one where Picard meets Kirk the other day. I can't remember what it's
Generations.
Called. And
Generations.
It's literally like they're making Kirk wear like an external truss.
Yeah. chopping logs.
He's like, yeah, he's chopping logs. Yeah. But he's like hoiked into this like waistcoat thing with a polo neck.
Well, Beck has asked to watch all Next Generation from the beginning. So we've got
what a treat.
So we've
what
got as far as the episode where they're on the sex planet and I know that doesn't narrow it down. On the
that
sex planet,
is the one
where Wesley like trips over the thing and they want to execute.
They
want
to kill him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the ones that like the cast were like, what are we making? And they like threatened to revolt because they were
it's
like,
very, it
dreadful.
Sounds very Gene Roddenberry.
But I didn't realize like until I watched it as an adult, how much they're just saying, we're all going to go down and have sex. And they take Will Wheaton's character down to see what it's like for children. And they're like saying, ooh. And they get up to him and say, can you have sex? And he's going, well, I haven't had sex yet. Okay, you can go over and it's like, what? Yeah.
What that season was probably is this? Cut is out of
the, season one.
The first season.
Season one and season two are really, really weird, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it only gets going after like, they change the collars on their outfits.
Yes.
And they don't have one pieces anymore.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I kept thinking about, can we skip to season three? She says, no, I want to watch all of it. So, okay.
From yesterday's Enterprise onwards, they're rocking from that. That's a great one. That's the one. Yeah, absolutely. Right.
Okay.
So anyway, meanwhile.
So where are we? This hasn't even started yet.
OC Island.
We haven't, but that's fine. Right, OC Island. While scenes to represent Crithin Gifford were filmed at the National Trust Village of Laycock near Chippenham, Wiltshire.
Were they really?
Apparently so. It premiered on Christmas Eve, 1989. Mm. I'm assuming on ITV, and it was an unexpected success. Though author Susan Hill reportedly disagreed with some of the slight changes made by the screenwriter, who was one of General Rich Witchfinder's favourites, Nigel Neal. Who most
that
of you will all
inserted
by
Cleaver.
Yeah. That's why I
be aware of as the writer of the eerie and downright terrifying the Quatermass Tetralogy and the classic The Stone Tape, The Road and Beasts. Six horror stories based around animals for ITV. And then go and check out episodes 5, 17, 27, and 34 for more Nigel goodness.
Canonical. In this episode, I am going to make a case for this thing that we're reviewing being part of the Ghost Story for Christmas canon, which is BBC.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's so much going for this that I think straight away, rewatching this, I haven't seen this for years. And the last time I saw it, it was on, as I said, in a message to you two earlier, at best, an impressionistic reading on YouTube, where I think was about like 72 DPI or something like that, or whatever the equivalent is for TV scan.
Hazy.
But
hazy.
It exists within the universe of Warning to the Curious, firstly. Whistle and I'll Come to You, the Horden one. It's so within that universe that in retrospect, I think that there's parts of it which are quite deliberate on Nigel Neal's part. It must be because they're...
It's kind of that era, but filmed in the style of the Anthony Brett Sherlock Holmes kind of...
Literally the first thing I've written is we're in the feel of Brett.
Yes.
Sherlock Holmes, which is... It starts exactly like that kind of thing, doesn't it? So it's a fairly luxurious 1980s ITV drama. when they were trying to kind of do fisticuffs with the BBC for like heavyweight stuff. Central didn't do many. It was usually like LWT or Yorkshire Television. But it's a nice one for Central, this is, because, they didn't do... All they did was Crossroads, pretty much, I think.
Yeah. When was the Michael Caine Jack the Ripper thing? What sort of...
A year before 90. This.
Yeah.
Oh, a year before?
Oh, no, I think it was 88. I think it was 80s, yeah. Wow. So it's a similar era to that. So they were putting big money into these, which I'm surprised with this. Yeah, Mega Victorian. I'm very, very surprised that they didn't have a bigger name for this, because the main guy is an unknown, really, isn't he? And I'm not totally convinced by him, but more on that as we go on.
Yeah. So, yes, we begin, don't we, with the fact that it was scene setting, and I get my notes was, I'm guessing this is the 20s. Because one of the cases, so he starts in a solicitor's office and they're talking about getting compensation for people, you know, suffering from
post-traumatic
stress. In the war. So I'm guessing it's the 20s, isn't it? That's kind of the vibe. And then we are introduced to our protagonist, who's Arthur Kidd. And that's one of the things that Nigel Neal had changed. It's Arthur Kipp.
It was a George Orwell name, which she lifted in the novel. And he didn't like the fact that she lifted someone else's name.
Oh, I see. Oh, I thought it was maybe to make out that he's quite kind of young and inexperienced and make it a very obvious kind of punished name. Yeah. What I've got to start off by saying is that it's very strong typography with the quite austere title sequence, Cleves. Do you like that typeface?
Yeah. It's nice.
It's a bit Black Sabbath-y, which being Central, maybe, you know, it's a Birmingham Brummy. maybe it's a particularly Brummy typeface or something. I don't know. Yes. But I thought that was kind of timeless, but also ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. But it was quite a cool intro, wasn't it? That typeface.
So I listened to the commentary on the Blu-ray. Can anyone guess who did the commentary?
It's Kim Newman.
It's Kim Newman. Kim Newman and Mark Gatiss.
Mark Gatiss.
No, it's Kim Newman, Mark Gatiss, and Andy Nyman.
Interesting.
And it's because Andy Nyman's in this as one of the sort of the.
Did you two sparks. Know beforehand that he was in this?
No, I didn't, no. But
I did because of the article that I'm going to bring to my attention. They interview him in that.
Got to the end and I was like, God, he's really familiar. Because the other Clark is very familiar as a TV actor of that era and later in the 90s, isn't he?
Yeah.
But then I was like, I don't know who that is. So I listened to find out the character's name. I was like, that's Andy Nyman. That's fucking mental. Like, he must have been about 14 when this was.
It was his first thing.
That's wild, isn't it? But that, again, ties into the whole Mark Gatiss, Ghost Story for Christmas kind of League of Gentlemen weird canon world that this thing has kind of created around itself.
Yeah, but one of the things he said was interesting is, because I thought, well, how did, later on you'll see this officer in, there's a fire in it, and I thought, how did they do that? That's all a set, and I think that's a brilliant set. The officers,
it is really good.
Yeah, and he said it was really great to like his first thing was actually filmed on a proper set with a bell which they rang when they were doing the takes and everything. And he said it was great. He said he tried to go in as every day he could, even if he was in it or not, because he just wanted. He was just so excited.
Speaking of my recent experience, which I don't know if we've mentioned to the listener yet.
No, well, we should say why we haven't been around for a little while.
Well, I've been for 2 months. I've been. I could probably say what it's called and who directed it and stuff, because it's been announced. So I was the stills photographer, and it's called unit stills photography, but I ended up doing a kind of documentary thing as well for the new Michael Sheen directed 3-episode thriller, for want of a better phrase. So it's called The Way, and it's on BBC One. Main BBC One next year sometime. Whoa. So it's not BBC One Wales, it's BBC One.
Proper BBC One.
It's networked, as they say in the trade. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been very exciting. But that's what I ended up doing, was even the days I wasn't wanted, I would go in and see what was happening, because you do get strangely drawn in and institutionalised to the mad...
From the little bit of film stuff I did on things... You just become really good friends with everyone.
Yes.
And then afterwards,
not like, everyone.
Oh. Well, a lot. And then you feel like we're going to be friends forever. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you never see him again.
Well, I've made a few pals. Yeah. So that's, yeah, I mean, that's been lovely because I, you know, I might do it again in some form because a lot of telly does seem to be made in South Wales at the moment.
Amazing.
But yeah, it's a kind of infectious thing where, yeah, you don't want to miss out. It's like that fear of missing out thing, I think. So yeah, so we're in a kind of clerk's office, solicitor's business with annoying clerks doing annoying laughter. And then our main character is called in to meet, David Ryle, who is one of my favourite British character actors, who is in a further case for this to be canon for Ghost Story of Christmas. He's in the Tractate Midoff that Mark Gatiss directed in 20...
Yeah. Is that the one?
I can't even remember which one.
Is that the one like in the library?
Yes.
Yes. With the master in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a good one. But he's very good in that. He's the nasty man in bed who. So they're all M.R. James stories. This particular group, and this is very Jamesian. And I'll say the bits that I've kind of zeroed in on later that I think particularly.
Can I give you a little one of the chapters? You know this. One of the chapters in the book is called "Whistle and I'll Come to You."
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. It's the bit when the dog gets lured away by the ghost.
I've never read the book. I've read like the first 10 pages of the book and I didn't like it. So I'll try reading it again. Ah, interesting. So yeah, so he's called in by David Ryle and he's basically told, you've got to go away for a week and you've got to go to this place. And it's kind of heavily implied that it's because his boss doesn't want to go. And then through expositional dialogue, you also find out that he's got a baby and a wife because the baby is spewed on his jacket. So that's quite neatly done.
I thought that was a little bit Jonathan Harker being sent off to Castle Dracula.
There is aspects of that. This for me, and I've written one of the first things I've written really is that this story either knowingly or unknowingly is like a collection of tropes all of the archetypes of horror and ghost Victorian fiction, isn't it? And they're all kind of put together. And Nigel Neal puts a bit of a modern spin on it in his way in this with the kind of use of the recording, you know, the imposition of modernity into tradition and the use of the recording techniques.
That was introduced because a lot of it's first person in the book. So they had to have a way of like getting some of that kind of narrative out.
But that's classic Nigel.
He loves a recording device.
Loves a recording device.
Yeah. Was it Wagner's ring cycle on a ball bearing?
So he's bought his. Then we see a scene where he's with his kid, and he's bought his kid a kazoo, which they both proceed to blow the wrong end of, which I thought was a bit weird.
They wouldn't be on. I haven't a clue, would they?
And they're in a really horribly overlit room. Which I think I've used this metaphor before. It's literally like someone is arc welding in the corner. And then when I was watching this on YouTube, their faces are just like blown out blobs because it was so overlit.
It's like a Davison Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yes, it's like Warriors of the Deep. So then this is my first Jamesian bit. There's a bit where when he's arrived, I think, in the place that he's been sent to, he's handed something. And the person says, I think this is yours. And I think that's very much a in-joke from Night of the Demon, where the curse is passed. Is it the main posh guy or squire or what, whatever it is?
Mr. Juvie.
Before
we get onto that, for me, the other kind of tropey bit was that, so he heads off to, what's it called again? Sorry, wait, where's the place that it's called?
The North.
Yeah.
The North.
Or the Midlands. Yeah.
That's right. Or wherever it is. Oh, dear. It sounds vague, you know, slightly Welsh, doesn't it?
Didn't write it down, James. No idea what it's called.
That's mad. I thought I did. Oh, God. Right. Okay, dreadful. Amateur. Right, anyway, so while he's on the train, he then starts talking to the man in the carriage who says, I couldn't help but notice your papers. Again, very kind of classic horror film, British horror.
This might be the man. Yeah, is this Bernard Hepton?
I believe so, yeah.
Yes, he
says, oh, you know, what are you coming, you know, why are you heading there for? And he explains to him, oh, you know, I'm a solicitor and I've been asked to go and deal with the affairs of this woman who has passed away. And he says, oh, will you be attending her funeral? Yes. And he says, oh, you'll be the only one there. And so they kind of suggest that he was the sort of unloved, you know, unliked person.
Mm.
And so that kind of setting up that feeling of dread. And then the best bit is that he turns up at the train station again, like a lot of the things we've seen, kind of provincial train stations, steam powered trains. And he gets off and he says, oh, I need a taxi to take me. And Mr. Tuvey says to him, a cab here at this time of night? And what I've written is, that is every provincial town in the UK today after 9 o'clock. If you turn up in any British town after 9 o'clock in a railway station and try to get a cab, you want a taxi after 9 o'clock at night? I thought, okay, nothing's changed.
Yeah, yes. I was stuck in Castle Carey for hours once.
There you go. Right. So,
did you know?
Right. So he then makes his way into town, stays in, once again, fantastic trope of the pub.
The grumpy landlord, isn't it?
Standard grumpy landlord immediately tries to boot him out, saying that he's gone past last orders.
Because he's looking for Ken Boone, that's why.
Yeah. I like the bit where there's a bit where he's eating there and they're all eating on long benches. And everyone thought that was amazing when Wagamama started doing that.
Right, hang on. I think Boone was also made by Central.
It was, I think, yeah.
So that guy had a massive payday, didn't he, from Central?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many episodes did you say he did of Boone?
Fuck. Hang on.
Like 90 episodes?
So like 89, I think.
Silver!
93 episodes of Boone in
84. Whoa! So say he was on £1,000 an episode.
Yeah.
Go figure, guys.
All right.
Yeah.
We should just count our lucky stars that Neil Morrissey didn't make an appearance. Given his,
Central. So that guy blessed the day that he saw the sign, the kind of moon sign with the rainbow the colours for Central Television.
The moon.
And I think, as far as I can see, the last time I saw Neil Morrissey, he was doing on a thing where a load of celebrities did the walk to Compostela in Spain, did the Pilgrim's Trail, one of whom was the Reverend Kate Botley from Gogglebox.
One of my favourite programmes of that kind of ilk was when they sent Joe Pasquale, the one who was Marlene off of Only Fools and Horses, and Biggins, off to Russia. And then they set it up to make it look like they were going to get like shot by some figures. Was just like, no, and it was like, call my agent.
Do you remember when Werner Herzog got shot being interviewed?
Yes, by Mark Kermode. Yeah. Again, it's all circular.
He was shot with an air rifle.
Yes, and he says it was an insignificant shot.
That's really weird.
And they put Joe Pasquale and Marlene down some rapids, but Christopher Biggins refused to do it.
Have we got to the bottom of Schofield's quest yet?
Oh,
God.
Well, okay. His quest isn't to conquer a teenage boy.
It was a long game.
It's that we should point out to listeners who aren't over, the other day, as often happens these days on social media, people find old copies of like the Radio Times and the TV Times. That's like TV Guide for our foreign, maybe American listeners. And someone put up one from sort of the apex of our youth, which is sort of like, I think it was 1994, because later on in the evenings, there were highlights from the World Cup 1994 on.
Yes.
And there was amazing.
Unless it was looking into the future or like looking far into the past, it would have been in that year, James, yes.
I know.
That was well deducted. Yes.
Thank you. Right, but it just said, oh, on ICV, Schofield's Quest. And it was like the highlighted thing to watch that night with a very detailed description of it.
Choice.
And it featured a lot of supernatural goings on that would be of great interest to us.
Normally, yeah, yeah.
And I said to these two straight away, we need to see Schofield's Quest.
We need
Quest.
To see this.
Yeah. We've got to find
it. Is it out there, Cleeds? Can you find a copy?
I was just going to read what happened in it on here.
Yes.
Philip Schofield turns celebrity sleuth for his one-hour special as he attempts to solve both earthly and psychic mysteries with the help of viewers and special guests and live in the studio.
Who were they? Who were the guests?
Amongst the riddles in the story are a Northamptonshire man who claimed he found a UFO in his back garden. An expert from the US, a UFO society, goes along to investigate, and viewers will be invited to offer any information they have seen or heard on the night of the landing. Schofield is joined in the studio by psychic Neela Jones, who has helped the police with previous investigations and will attempt to find clues for another unsolved mystery. Mm. Ex-Top of the Pops presenter Tony Doughty goes to an Elvis auction in Las Vegas, hoping to pick up some relics of the king, and Karen Keaton visits Oldham in Hampshire,
no
reputed to be the most mysterious place in Britain.
Oh.
Mysterious for what? Who knows?
Mm. Yeah. Well, there you
we
go.
We need to find that. We need to
review
it.
We do.
Yeah.
Is there any the ancient ram in? Does it make an appearance on?
No, maybe that was would have, if it got picked up for a series. Maybe that would have been the next one.
So where are we at? Because I got to take my glasses off to
so
read.
He's turned up. He's our protagonist Arthur Kidd has turned up in the town.
Oh yes,
and people start to again give him the feeling that. You know, spooky house out there.
The one
that you've turned up. There are no
living guy out there.
Yeah, there's no living relatives. Everyone's died off, etc.
Everyone's dead.
Right, and funeral tomorrow. So we then have the funeral, and I did say that
after a really weird market sequence where there's no dialogue, and they walk through the market and they don't say anything, and you're like, why are they so heavily trailing that it's a market day, and you don't find out until after that scene, do you?
Which is quite
weird. It, you know, they could at least say they might say it's market day, but then they walk through all these people, and there's no dialogue. It's really weird.
He says that like the pub landlord says, "Oh, it's market day tomorrow. It'll be really, really busy."
Mm.
But that's as much as we get.
And then it's just gypsy selling bunches of heather.
Oh, more on that in a minute.
Yeah.
Because I've got a little heather-based anecdote. It's not very exciting, listeners.
It's not Heather from EastEnders.
It's not, but I didn't have to wait that if it was.
I was watching Best of Harry Hill the other night on YouTube, and there was a whole thing. They went on for 9 months, apparently, where... I forgot that Heather got pregnant, and it was like, who is the father of Heather?
Yeah. It was the young boy. Was it Darren or someone like that?
But just say there's loads on Scofield's Quest on YouTube, including a Doctor Who special.
It's just everyone's just sent it through.
Whoa.
It's a picture of Sylvester McCoy, eyebrows raised high.
Yeah.
Long hair.
Yeah, sort of a TV movie era, I think that is.
Still amazing.
Right. So we then have the funeral, and I did say that whoever the location manager was, they may have been limited, but I was expecting it to be a really creepy church.
Yes,
and it's quite a well maintained church. Yeah, isn't
it's quite
it?
It's a like, shit oh. trad Victorian church isn't it, at this part. Yeah.
But then it starts to ramp up. We get the funeral service, and amazingly, and this is what I liked about it, they didn't do the whole, ooh, is there something coming out of the darkness there? No. Arthur Kidd turns round. And there she is. There is the woman in black. She sort of stood at the back of the church. And it's really effective.
It's really effective.
Like that.
Yeah.
There she is.
I've got to say from the outset, I preferred this immensely to the Radcliffe version, which is just the most overcooked.
So many jump scares in it.
Melodramatic.
It just goes on and on,
isn't it? And every 5 minutes is another kind of emotional roller coaster of
jump scares.
Excuse me, I'm burping. Yes. I'll try that again.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
All I would say, though, for the record version is that I felt like I understood what the story was better in that one, whereas even though I knew what the story was in this version, I found it quite difficult to sort of, like, follow.
Yeah, was that because you were designing a poster and reading a book at the same time? Sat on the toilet, watching it at double speed on one screen, with your eyes held open, with, like...
The truth will out. Yeah.
I don't know what's happening here while he's cooking mince.
We get raw mince.
Right, so following the funeral, he's walking out and he's talking to, it's not Mr. Tooby this time, is it? It's somebody else. It's another one of sort of like the town
is it
elders.
The, like the land, is the it, land agent or yeah. something like that.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's him. And then he says, oh, did you see that old woman? And he's like, I didn't see anybody.
But he starts shitting himself, though.
Yeah, but yeah. And as they're walking out,
fills his pants.
This is one of the only bits that I thought they didn't quite do it properly. that as they're walking out, a number of the kid, they have a number of kids, all of whom are like going, ah, and sort of pointing over into the distance.
Yes.
And Arthur Kidd
can
says,
can the kids see her? That's the thing.
Yeah, no, can they see her? And he's like, see who? And the other guy, and is refusing to look up in any way, shape, or form.
Yes. Now,
and that's why he says, go away! Yeah. Go away, children! But that's the thing is, I thought it would be much creepier if the kids were just stood there staring at
me. Yes.
They
that's
were
much
too
more
jovial.
Wickerman-y, isn't it? With the
that's right. They were too and sort of dancing around. If they had just been stood there staring at her, I think that would have been a bit more.
It was a bit too much Baker Street Irregulars for me.
It was. So yes, the elder land agent shoos them all away, and then you know, so you start to. And that's our first clue that if you see the woman in black, woe betide. You know, poor.
We haven't met PC Ventress from Heartbeat yet, have we?
Not yet. Because then he goes back into the town. Market day is still on.
Yes,
and
yes,
to
yes.
A very long scene. That we won't go into the logistics of it because it's too long. Yes. But basically, there was a log-based disaster.
Yes.
And that wasn't me this morning.
After the bang cauliflower.
There's a truck carrying a load of logs, which, you know, I think... When I think about how this ends, I'm like, oh, that's a bit of a portent in a way, thinking about it.
Yes.
And the logs fall from the back of the truck.
And the guy ropes all fell
off. And the logs fall down and hit one of the gypsy children who was selling heather earlier and was looking at the woman in black.
Yeah.
And Arthur Kidd runs to her aid and assistance and basically saves her before further logs fall off and hit the ground.
Big, heavy logs.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that my note was one of the only times I got a bit weirded out in London when I was an undergraduate in London. I thought of myself being quite streetwise. Both my sisters lived in London. I'd been up there a lot. Yes. But when I was in my first year, I was walking through Leicester Square and a woman, she wasn't an old woman. I would have said she was sort of like in her 50s, just came up to me and said, can I sell you this? And even at 18, I was like, what do you mean, sir? Sell me what? She went, I have here some very, very lucky heather.
Oh.
And it'll bring you really, really good fortune. And because of the way that she had, like, spoken to me, and I was like, I didn't quite know how to deal with her. Mm-hmm. I kind of went, and she was walking really, really closely to me by now. You know, I hadn't stopped walking, but she was, like, keeping stride with me. Yeah. And I just thought, I just wanted to go away. So I just kind of went, oh, all right. And I had, like, two pound coins in my pocket.
Which in those days... Excuse. Could buy you a new car, Jack.
Yeah, that's right. I could have got a pint out of that. And I just went, oh, here you are. And she went, oh, wonderful, thank you. You're a very lucky man, which is absolutely not true at all.
Well, you might be crushed by logs if you had it.
You don't know, James.
That's right. Yeah. And then I was given, so I am someone who has purchased lucky heather in my life. Oh, yes. And then afterwards, it was one of those things, like 10 minutes later, I was like, what a fucking idiot. Oh, what? Why did I do that? Why did I do that? But it was the only time in my life living in London that I felt like, I didn't quite know what was going on, and I was wrong-footed. Yes. Anyway, I told you it wasn't that good. So.
Hi, it's Ross from the General Witchfinders. Did you know that I also do another podcast with my friend David?
Hello. Well, I like headphones for that. You're not taking this seriously, Ross.
David and I do our own supernatural research and investigations in our home county of Dorset. So, if you think that's up your street, why don't you give it a listen? It's Dark Darset, D-A-R-Z-E-T. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
It's not that.
I've never seen... I don't think I've ever seen an episode of Heartbeat.
Ah. Sunday night, ICV.
I don't think I've watched much.
I mean, other things in our teenage years.
I'm probably a Heartbeat completist. I've probably seen pretty much all of it and all of The Royal, I would have thought.
Even when Rixie left.
I continued watching, yeah. Me and Hel would always watch Heartbeat and The Royal. I mean, The Royal was filmed in Scarborough, so it was a lot of, look at that. where Jimmy Savile lived.
Yeah.
I've got a weird amount of respect for Nick Berry because he's just like
because that's the opening line.
Because he just said, anyway, he was a really big star on TV. You know, huge. Heartbeat was a massive hit.
Yes,
he'd had Every Loser Wins. Well, yeah, song. Yeah. Had that been number one?
Yeah, I think that's number one. Yeah.
He'd been like a big star, and then he was just like, "Oh, of course you did, Ross."
Yeah, along with the Anita Dobson version of the EastEnders theme.
And his theme,
yeah.
Anyone can fall in love. That's the easy part. You must keep it going. That's the only bit that I can remember.
So number four, it's Dobson's choice.
So, not at the peak of his powers, but bearing in mind, you know, most people in showbiz, like, keep it going and what have you, he just said, I've had enough of this. And he's just quit, hasn't he? He's never had anything since.
Yeah. His last thing was called Harbour Lights, I think. Simon May, not Simon Day.
I've got a lot of time for people who just go, I've had enough of that now. That's enough.
Where is Nick?
After
quitting acting, Nick Berry set up his own TV and film company, Valentine Productions.
Ooh,
he resigned from his production house in 2019. His romance with his girlfriend, Gillian Telfer, caused a stir.
Gillian Telfer? Good God.
As he played his stepmother, Kathy Bale. I didn't realise
that. Hold on. No. You mean relieving pancreatitis? in a lay-by, Gillian Telfer.
Apparently so.
Because
I was just about to play the EastEnders theme tune, but my phone has shut down.
We should point out for our foreign listeners, both of you, hello, that Gillian Telfer was also in EastEnders, which the aforementioned Nick Berry was in. And she was involved in a minor scandal in the fact that she was caught basically giving oral sex to her partner. In a lay-by.
Yeah, in a Land Rover Discovery.
There's the detail that people come to this podcast for. And her excuse was that she was caught, that he was someone who suffered from pancreatitis.
Yeah.
So yes. An issue of the pancreas, and she was relieving his pancreas.
Oh, yeah. I just put a picture of, said she would not recognise Nick Berry now. I put a picture on our WhatsApp. He looks a bit like you, John, with short hair.
I can't look because my phone's shut.
Oh, no.
What's he up to?
No, he doesn't. Well, he's got the same kind of...
Hold it up, James. Let's have a look.
He's got
grey hair.
The scarf.
He's got the scarf.
I haven't worn that scarf for about 15 years.
Oh, well, that's
and glasses. But that's it.
Yeah, he looks cool, I think.
Yeah, hats off to him.
He gets taken out there by PC Ventress from TV's Heartbeat, not in a Ford Anglia with a police thing on the top, but on a horse and cart. And then there's lots of nice dialogue about sea frets coming in and the name of the causeway is Nine Lives Causeway and blah, 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 blah. And then he goes into the house and he does a bit of exploration of the house. But there's a rather nice setup of a fake graveyard, which is very, very like Michael Horden's fake graveyard.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll come to.
Yeah, with the iconic sort of ruined archway.
Which, yes. Plays, yeah, which is which is from the Caspar David Friedrich painting, which is also referenced in Doctor Who's Warrior's Gate, which is one of Tom Baker's season 18 finales, etc.
For the purposes of story and explication, we should point out as well that where he's gone to is called Eel Marsh House. And we're told that so it's been kind of built out in this bit of land, which is inaccessible because, you know, the tide comes in and cuts it off.
Mm, yeah.
And also, as John says, as he's on the way there, we're told that you can die. That if you get caught out there, if you go off the path,
you get
the
lost,
tide will come in, you can be sucked into the sands, whatever it may be. It's highly dangerous, so you can only travel that path. Again, you know, you've got to be a real recluse, haven't you? So I want to say, right now, where do I want my big mansion to be? I want it to be so you can only get to it for 1 hour a day. Or
yes.
I hate people.
It's the kind of place where Roger Daltrey would live, basically.
Yes.
It's where he had his trout farm. So do we see her at this point, don't we? And she pops
we
up
too.
So he walks out, kind of out of this graveyard, and there's a very clever way where he does it in real time and walks, and she must have stood up somehow on cue from the director, and because as he walks out of frame, she is kind of revealed behind him, which is really, really, really effective. And it's very well done. All the effects in this are basically practical effects. There's no CGI or anything like that.
Of course.
And they always work all the better for that because it's just much more creepy.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that I saw the new indie film recently and
all right, yes.
I was running up to it.
When you said indie, I thought you meant independent.
No, Indiana Jones films. I've been watching all of the old films running up to this with my kids to get them excited about watching
it.
I'm not going to go into my full review, but yeah, some brilliant stuff in it. But I was thinking that the old ones work so well because the stunts
are real.
And like, when you're watching the... Watching a lot of it, I know there were some stuff, but a lot of it you're watching about, it's not happening. So
I'm not really that.
As soon as I
saw the trailer for it, I was just like, oh, the bit where he's jumping from a tram to a tram or something. I thought, he's 80 years old. He hasn't done that really. They've got him on a harness and green screen.
Or if he's even there at all.
Yeah, exactly.
But when I went to see, I had to go and watch The New Little Mermaid with my daughter. I fell asleep twice in it. But I was saying that if I saw that as a kid, you'd be just thinking, how is she swimming around like that? It looks really good, but because you know none of it's real, you're just like, I don't care. You know?
There's no wonder in it is
the lack of verisimilitude. You can just tell that it doesn't feel real. When you look at certain things.
Yeah, it's like in a Bond film, there's a bit in Indiana Jones film, he jumps out of a plane.
Yeah.
With a parachute on, holding on to someone. Mm. If you saw that in a Bond film with Roger Moore, you knew that was real. It wasn't obviously not Roger Moore, but...
The close-up would be Roger Moore with his wig flapping around. And then the wider shot would be a guy who looked nothing like Roger Moore, but with the same slacks on.
And when he'd land with his parachute, he'd walk past a man who would be sat in a cafe drinking some alcohol, and he'd go, good afternoon. And then the man would do a double take and look at the bottle he was drinking.
And throw it over his shoulder.
They were very pleased with that joke, weren't they?
I watched a bit of Spy Who Loved Me today, and it's so excellent. The bits, Jaws. Like, the bits with Jaws are played totally as a horror film.
Yeah.
Because he bites through people's neck.
Yep. My kids were really scared of him in Moonraker.
Oh, good,
I had to turn it off.
Yeah, the bit in Moonraker where he comes along in the Mardi Gras and that woman is in that kind of weird, like, derelict building is terrifying. Mm. It's amazing. So where are we? We've got to...
Okay. So they also set up the house, and then he goes in... They set up that there's an electric generator in there where you have to get going in order to get the electric lights.
Get lights.
So that's another good... Nigel Neal kind of it's like the imposition of technology onto tradition again, isn't it? So it's like, it's an old house, but it's got electric light. And then when you see him go into the house, he puts all the lights on in a very overt way.
Yes. And Arthur Kidd then finds, as we were talking about earlier, the very Nigel Neal touch, he finds that they had a an early tape kind of wax cylinder recorder. Yeah. He records himself, and I was so expecting the voice of the ghost.
Yeah.
Yes. I was so, and then when they didn't do it, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
But there was again, that's very Dracula, because Dr. Yeah. Seward has like wax cylinders for his.
Similar thing. Yeah. It's Thomas Edison, I think, designed
them. But there was a really, when I went to see that one man show Dracula thing.
Yes.
The best bit in it was when he so the whole setup was that this guy's researching Bram Stoker, and they realised that all of those diary entries and stuff were actually real. And then they found a wax cylinders with Dracula's actual voice on it. And they play that in the theatre. And that was the creepiest bit. And they said, if this is real, that person's voice was alive at the time of Attila the Hun. And all this kind of, and it was just, it was great.
So we then get the kind of, what I think a lot of people would consider to be the classic Woman in Black, you know, because people that are familiar with the stage play and things such as that, in that we get kind of haunted house elements going on. I mean, that first of all, he hears at night sort of like the sound of horses in distress, child screaming, you know, he can't see anything, and he thinks there's people there. There's not, as John was saying. So, and this
the very Nigel Neal trope again, the recurring kind of
the recorded
recording of a disaster, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. And he then kind of, after spending a very kind of disturbed night in the Ilmarsh house, he makes his way back. And then while he's there, he then kind of gets a dog.
Spider.
And again, we get more information from people that live locally about, what was the deal with the Ilmarsh house?
Yeah, goes to meet the kind of sort of the squire chap. And they kind of imply that they never had children, but I think the truth is that they had children and they died.
They do.
Yes. Yeah. Well, because the one gravestone is their family name, isn't it?
Yeah. And then you start to realize the curse is that whenever someone sees the Woman in Black, children die.
Yes.
At this point, I started to question, if there's a graveyard on the island, why is the woman that died being buried in the very prim Victorian graveyard?
That didn't
make sense to me.
May have made it a request in the will.
Yeah.
It should have been elaborated on, shouldn't it? Because it's kind of like you spend time visiting both graveyards, and it's like if she lived on that island and made a big thing about staying there alone, surely she would have been interred there.
Possible. You know, my other Nigel, surely. Thing is that at one point, because he mentions Arthur Kidd says to people, oh, you know, I saw her, I saw the Woman in Black, and then I sort of ran away. And I put, wouldn't you go, as we saw, you know, when we did the Dickens one, hello, at least try, because she's so physically there.
Yes,
wouldn't you address? And then somebody said, oh, did her powers freak you out? You know, did she do something? And he's like, no, absolutely not. No, yeah. I wasn't scared.
I'm not afraid. So,
then why don't you talk to her? And then later on, when we get to the big jump scare, he does start talking. I found that like quite an odd choice.
Yes.
And that was the only thing that for me sort of took me out of it a little. I thought, surely you'd go, hey. And even if they don't say anything back, just the notion of, hey, all right. You know, I'm no Nigel Neal, obviously. Arthur Kidd then says, look, I've not finished going through the papers yet. And he also kind of senses that there's a mystery at work here. And having seen the Woman in Black, he says he's going to go back, and he continues going through the files, doesn't he? Again, more psychological things start happening to him. He hears the screams again, you know, what have you.
And he hears a child's voice. And there's one room which he didn't have a key to last time he was there.
And then the bouncing football.
And the ball, it goes in there, and there's a child, the sound of a child playing, and then a ball comes bouncing out.
And I think all these bits, because they're so paired back, are much more effective than in the Daniel Radcliffe version. Because in the Daniel Radcliffe version, at this point, you've had like a hanging, you've had all, it's like this.
You would leave. Yeah, you would leave.
Yeah, like you wouldn't keep going back in there, would you? Like, well, I think I might you know, might just put my mind at rest. You know, I'll go in one last time after you've seen her hanging from the bloody playroom. and it similarly with the Kieran Hines character in the Daniel Radcliffe version, like him and his wife, that is much more overblown, isn't it? Because the wife is portrayed as being totally loopy, and this version is a lot more low key. It's much less melodramatic, and I think it's more effective for that. I'm sure lots of other people prefer the Daniel Radcliffe version, because I think the Daniel Radcliffe version is more scary, but it's just jump scares, isn't it? Whereas this one...
It's more of a ghost train, that one.
Yeah, this one is much more... It's just a feeling of dread. By the time you get to the end, you really get the feeling that this guy is losing his marbles.
Yeah. So there's a cool bit where you hear the ghost of the child, and then he's got like this metal soldier just in his hand, as if like the child has put it into his hand.
And that becomes a recurring theme of...
And that's when all the lights go out.
Yeah, that's when she's going to appear then, isn't it?
I also thought with the significance of the fact that it is a metal soldier and the time it was written, I did think either my general feeling was, I think they definitely could have made it that he was a veteran of the First World War.
He probably would have
played up the whole traumatized by experience of war. And if you were doing it today, maybe the whole, is he really seeing this, or is he just going a bit bonkers?
I think that's a very good idea, James.
Thank you. But yeah, that was just, and the whole, the significance of the soldier, I thought, the time they're in, they could have really lent on that.
But
that's by the way.
But that's when, so all the lights go out, so he has to rush out to get the generator going again. And that's when the ghost whistles for the dog, and the dog is lured off onto the marsh.
Yes.
And then the wind starts coming, and he can't keep the door shut on the house and stuff.
Which is very similar to the written story of "Oh, Whistle and I'll Come to You."
Mm-hmm.
When he first blows the whistle, it blows in and it opens his window and stuff.
Yeah, but that's what in the book, that's what that chapter's called.
Yes. So that's, and I didn't know that, so that's, I'm glad I noticed that. Roundabout now, there's a scene where he's talking to Bernard Hepton, and you can see the boom shadow on the top of the lampshade, which I thought was quite funny. But there's a bit where he's listening to the audio diary of the lady living in the house. And I think that part is very much like the diary in the stalls of Barchester Cathedral, which is M.R. James, where the guy keeps writing, "I must be firm, I must be firm," into his diary page, to the point that he breaks the nib of his pen. And it seems very similar with what she's saying, that she's not going to be scared by her own kin, I think she says.
It's her sister, isn't it?
Because it turns out it's her sister who's had a bastard child.
Yeah. And who they take on as their own. But then, so we should probably, I don't know if this is the point where you find out the plot, but maybe.
Is this a spoiler?
So
something that's 40 years old.
Yeah. So essentially, what's happened is one of these two sisters, as John said, had a child out of wedlock, and in order to cover up the scandal,
misdemeanor.
Yeah, the married sister takes that child on as her own, and then this sort of drives the mother, the real mother, a little bit loopy, and then she tries to kidnap the child and escape, but then they get they come off the road and they end up dying in the marsh, and then that sort of vengeful ghost then just starts haunting at the town and killing other children.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah,
there you go. So yes, that's the long and the short of it. So
my notes.
Yes, because and the idea of the fake out, I suppose, is that you think that the woman who you're seeing buried and the woman who's there to take care of her notes, she's the woman in black. No, she's not the woman in black. It's her sister.
Yes.
Who's the woman in black. So
this is the point where this is probably the first thing that's actually scared me watching. Out of all the things we've watched on Jim and Witchfinder, this is the bit. I got creeped out by watching Ghostwatch again. This is the bit which actually scared me.
No way!
Yeah. So he's going through all of the paperwork and everything back at the his sort of digs, and then he can't sleep, and then he wakes up, he finds the little metal soldier underneath his pillow.
Yes.
And then suddenly she's fucking there, right?
No. First of all, Ross, like I said, we hear the child's voice, and he starts to talk to the child. He basically says, like, "Can you hear me? Can you,
Because he thinks it's the ghost of the child, which is about to come there, basically. Yeah.
And he's like, who are you? Where are you? And the child says, this is for you. This is for you.
Oh, I don't remember this part.
This bit. And then he's like, oh. And then when he looks up, bang, there she is.
Oh, that's, And that's the major scary bit, isn't it?
And I'm watching it on YouTube now, and it shit me up then, watching it.
It's really, really effective. It's very well done. And I don't know how it's done, because it's like, she kind of glides in above, doesn't she? So she must have been on some kind of dolly.
She's doing that.
screaming.
And it's one of those things where it stays there longer than it needs to be. Yes. That makes it scarier still.
Yeah. Because he's screaming and screaming in bed, and it goes on for like quite a long time. Yeah, it's excellent.
So Andy Nyman said that when they were doing the play of Ghost Stories, which James and I were lucky enough to go and see.
Yes.
He said there was a jump scare in there, which he said it wasn't working. So he went back and watched this because he knew this is like one of the most effective jump scares ever.
Yes.
And he said the fact that after it cut to black, the screaming carried on after that point. And then when they did that in the play, and they said that's what made it work. So when it cut to black, the screaming carried on. And he said after that point, it was the effect that he wanted. But it's cool that he went back to the thing which he was initially in.
And the original probably went to an advert for Finder's Crispy Pancakes.
And then, so poor old Arthur Kidd then, that really kind of lays him out. And we kind of see that he's in sort of like a comatose
in a funk
state. Yes, for a period of time, we're told that he has a fever. And then the fever
bang,
breaks.
Bang, cauliflower.
And bang, cauliflower. And then he starts to, he comes around and we find that his wife has come to basically collect him and basically rescue him and bring him back to London, which is then what happens. And they kind of bid everyone adieu in. It's Crithlyn Gifford, isn't it? That's the half founder. Crithlyn Gifford. Yes, I have written it down. So they kind of bid adieu to the people of Crithlyn Gifford. And the one couple, as they wave them off, are like, oh, it's so, they're so young. And
I hope it's
kind
over.
Of aware. Yes.
Yes.
Aware of that the tragedy is following them. And
well, there's still 20 minutes to go, isn't there?
That's something's giveaway. And this is you know, one of the interesting things is that it is a ghost story where the ghost is not just located in one place.
No.
The ghost follows you.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's nice. That was interesting to see, you know, things such as It Follows and The Ring and things, you know, things that have followed since.
Yeah.
This was many ways the original. No, just because you've gone away, the ghost is still with you. So, Mr. Kidd sort of pulls himself together enough, goes back into the office and says, you know, there's nothing left. And we're told that the house has burnt down.
Yes.
Bernard Acton implies that he has burnt it down.
Yes.
Yeah, they were still on the commentary saying, obviously, they couldn't afford to show that. So that all had to happen off screen.
Which I think... It's fine because it's effective storytelling to just be like, his implication is more interesting than seeing some gas burners squirting out of a window.
They could have just done a bit of stock footage of a Hammer film, couldn't they?
Beam falling.
And then all we're left with then is Mr. Kidd is told, okay, well, you know, all we've got then, you know, if there's no money, there's, you know, that... You can't sell the house for anything. It's gone. It's been destroyed. So they just say to him, well, all that's left are these papers for you to go through. And as he goes through them, he sees a picture of the woman in black when she was still alive. And he starts freaking out.
Actually, she's pretty good looking.
She's hot, you know, maybe. And then so we have this kind of mad scene where he just decides, okay, well, I'm going to burn the lot.
Yeah.
And he kind of pours kerosene on all the papers.
In his office, on the floor. He doesn't even try and get it into the fireplace, does he?
But he also confronts his boss by saying, you knew what you sent me.
But you knew it was something
you've
weird.
You've been there before. You were scared to go.
Yeah, your pants.
Yeah. And did he try to strangle him?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And then I put just in office pyromania.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, kind of, he does. And I did think at the time, like, Jesus, you know, it's an office full of paper.
Yeah.
Not just his office. It's like, this place would go up like that.
Yeah.
You know, but somehow they do manage to contain it just to his office. Don't we?
Yes.
You then see like a 1920s fireman kind of going, yep, I thought so. Kerosene. And then he goes and sort of takes umbrage with Mr. Kid and goes, "Well, what were you doing, you bloody maniac? Yeah. Are you mad?" That's, yeah.
Andy Nyman said that it was great because said they were filming that and then they all went off to lunch and when they came back, they redressed the set as if it'd been burnt. And he said it was just amazing to see that that transformation just over their lunch break that they managed
to get. No way.
Yeah.
Showbiz. And yeah, so he is then told by his boss, right, you know, he doesn't say you're fired, which is quite remarkable, really. You know, yeah, you think about what you can get fired for.
Yeah.
I did try and set fire to the office and attack you. Yeah. Well. He just says, go home and stay at home, yeah. Doesn't he? So he then takes himself home and then, you know, kind of wants to then spend more time with his family. And we end up have this sequence of them going to a park together.
Mm-hmm.
And then from what I'd read from my kind of advanced reading, I was expecting it to be a horse, an out of control horse, well, that's going to trample.
That's in the book.
That's in the book. Oh, yeah. Yes. Right. Okay. But no, they get on board a small rowing boat and they're kind of carousing around.
Pleasure
boating out in the middle of this lake, which is a very kind of autumnal lake, isn't it? It's looks very cold. And
it looks horrible.
And then he looks up and, oh my God, there she is. Pulling it off, I mean, a bit of a Jesus. She's walking on water. She's just on the water.
And very effective again. Beautifully shot again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a tree falls on them.
He's so transfixed by the woman in black and the woman in black staring at him that the next moment you hear his wife go, ah! And the boat crashes into a tree. So again, call back to the logs earlier.
Yes.
And the tree kind of cracks and splits and falls on them. And we never see them drowned. But the final shot is of this tree submerged in the water and nothing else besides.
We don't see them surface.
No. So roll credits.
So how did Daniel Radcliffe die? Was he run over by a train?
He's run over by a train. Hugging the ghost of his wife or something like that. The end of the Daniel Radcliffe
one. She's on the train.
Quite convoluted. Yeah, it's really weird. It's
and doesn't the ghost of the other woman come and fight the other ghost?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
I think she comes and finds her child at the end as well.
Right, so that was The Woman in Black. What do we think of that, guys?
I thought it was very effective. I thought it was better than the Radcliffe one in lots of ways.
Mm.
The standout scene for me in the Radcliffe one is where they use the Rolls Royce to pull the cart out of the bog.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Radcliffe goes into the bog. And because that for me would be really, there's no way I could go into a bog and pull out a cart. So I found that a very effective scene. And I thought that was really well shot as well. So it doesn't have any of those parts, but I think it has its own dynamic anyway, which is, you know, it's an hour and 40 and it's not boring at all.
No.
I think the main guy is a bit forgettable. Really, but I think otherwise, everyone else is excellent in it, and it's really good.
I think the first time I watched it, I was comparing it too much to the 2012 version.
Oh, it's totally different,
it was almost like too slow for me. But I watched that about a month ago. I watched it again recently, and going in with different expectations, I really enjoyed it. So I give it a 3.5 out of 5.
I'd probably be about the same. I don't think it's a classic Nigel Neal because it's not Nigel Neal. But I think it's a good adaptation of something else. And I think that he adds some good Nigel Neal tropes to it. And I think it's interesting in itself if you view it in a prism which is more to do with the ghost stories for Christmas and a world which is... A Warning to the Curious with Peter Vaughan and Horden, Kangaroos Australia. because that is very comforting and, you know, I watch them every 3 months. So it kind of fits more in with them than it does with the Radcliffe version, which is kind of just a modern horror film, isn't it, really? It's just like hits you over the head with jumps for... an hour and a half, and then it finishes.
James, what did you think?
It's a rare time where we're in agreement. For me, it was I enjoyed it. I said, so as John says, like if you think of it as one of the ghost stories for Christmas, very effective like that. Interesting choices. I said some nicely spooky moments as well. So a solid 3 out of 5 for me.
It's really spooky, and there's some good scares in it.
Has anyone seen the play?
No.
Is it still
on? I know people who have. Because the scary thing is that she walks through the crowd. That's the thing that they did, or that was the big secret in inverted commas that they would never tell people. That you know, it'd be very dark, and that she would like walk through the central aisle, and you know, so you could see her really close up, and people were quite spooked by it. But in lieu of something horrific, when we said we were going to do this, I thought, I'm sure I remember reading an article about this a little while back. And lo and behold, yeah, you know, I did. And it was an article on The Guardian written by Andrew Mayle. He was a very prolific sort of culture writer for The Guardian. And it says, The Woman in Black, Why Did Britain's Scariest Horror Film Disappear? Right, so check this out. Now, it starts off with a quote from Kim Newman. Of course it starts off with a quote from Kim Newman.
TV's Kim Newman.
It's Tim Newman. So we'll skip that bit, and we'll just cut straight to the meat of it. And it says this. Few horror films have acquired the cult reputation of Herbert Weiss's TV production of The Woman in Black. Adapted by visionary British sci-fi screenwriter Nigel Neal, of course,
visionary.
From Susan Hill's 1983 novella, it stars a 31-year-old at the time, Adrian Rawlins, as Edwardian solicitor Arthur Kidd, sent to settle the estate of an eccentric widow, Mrs. Drablow, on the northeast coast of England, apparently. There, in a remote house at the end of a shingle causeway, he is tormented by terrifying noises and cries and appearances from a tall woman dressed in black, Pauline Moran, who comes to exert a malevolent hold over his life. First broadcast on ITV at 9 p.m. on Christmas Eve 1989, it haunted all who watched it, thanks in part to Weiss's tense economical direction and one of the greatest jump scares in the history of horror. It created a genuine physical reaction, wrote Nancy Banks Smith in The Guardian, as if one layer of your skin had shifted over another. The film was a hit with critics and audiences alike, and yet while Hill's book went on to sell millions and become a set GCSE text, and Stephen Mollatrat's stage adaptation began a West End run in 1989 that was halted by COVID-19, Weiss's film slid into relative obscurity. After briefly servicing on, get this, W.H. Smith's own brand VHS label in 1991, and then screened on Channel 4 in 1994, it disappeared. Partly owing to its scarcity, a mystique grew around it, with copies passed from hand to hand on dubbed VHSs and hooky vid DVDs. In later years, it's made fleeting illegal appearances on YouTube, accompanied by comments speculating darkly on the reasons for its disappearance. The League of Gentlemen creators are vocal fans. Reith Shearsmith has called it the most terrifying program I've ever seen, whilst Oscar-winning director Guillermo del Toro, no less, cites it in his list of favorite supernatural films. What are the reasons for its enduring power? Why did it disappear? And why, after all this time, is it coming back? Andy Nyman, co-creator, of course, and Jeremy Dyson, Ghost Stories, etc., etc., has particular interest in the films it gave him his first ever acting role, age 23, as a young office clerk. It will always remain special, he says. A huge inspiration to me and Jeremy when we were writing Ghost Stories was the way that Herbie Wise creates this drab, ordinary sense of despair with long, elegant single shots. But another important detail is Rawlins' performance as Arthur Kidd. He has boyish likability. A good man who does nothing wrong. It's inexplicable anything bad should happen to him. But
Yeah. I can see what they're saying there.
Rawlins agrees. You grow to like my character, says the 62-year-old star of Chernobyl now and the Harry Potter films. When the bad things happen, there's a part of you thinking, you can't do that. There's a famous point in the film, and even though I was in it, I'm watching it going, oh my God, no, that's not right. I'm assuming the jump scare there. Yeah. Much of the film's power lies in Moran's portrayal of the woman in black herself, particularly the wordless, withering glares of the hatred she directs at Rawlins' characters. I was cast in my ability to convey malevolence with no warmth at all, says Moran, and now a sprightly 72. In those days, I was quite pre-Raphaelite and ethereal. There's a sadness in there, a pure hate for what's being done to her. I try to convey what's happening in her mind.
She's very pretty, that's the thing. It's quite weird, isn't it? She by the conventions, look like a kind of haggard witch or...
True. As I say, and by the conventions of the modern horror film, the woman in black is seen rarely, and with one big exception, from a distance. I deliberately didn't show her close up, the late Wise told journalist Toby Earnshaw in 2015, because then the audience can construct a face which is horrible to you, your personal horror. After the film came out, Susan Hill sort of dismissed it, says Moran. I suppose she felt because it became Nigel Neal's version, but Nigel knows what he's doing. He wrote Quatermass and the Stone Tape. Right. So, and then it goes on. And basically, in short, what it says is that Speaking in 2015, Chris Burt, the producer of the 1989 film, says it was really bizarre. The rights were owned by three film technicians, what? A makeup artist, a costume designer, and an assistant director. They couldn't get the project off the ground, so I offered to come in with them. I never understood why it never received a DVD release, but there was allegedly trouble between those three technicians Central.
Well, there yes, you go. That's probably the issue, because Central folded in the 90s or something, and a lot of the ITV regional stuff was very messy because companies bought companies and then they disappeared and they disappeared.
Yeah, it's out on Network now, but Network's just gone bust, hasn't
Network
it?
Network have gone, yeah.
So you probably can't get it anymore.
No.
And then finally, the last paragraph says, one thing worth pointing out, says Kim Newman, of course, is that the woman in black is one of the few English ghosts who is not tied to her location. Also, in his adaptation, Neil omits all her motivation. In that sense, she prefigures those characters from Japanese horror films like Ring. She's a malevolent, non-specific spirit. Even Hill has finally come round to the adaptation. It is very frightening, she says. Even ever since its first transmission, I've been asked if it will ever be shown again. Now it is. And if anyone complains that it has changed the book, my answer is always the same. Of course it hasn't. The book is still there for everyone to read and quite unchanged.
And my bank account is even more swelled than it was before.
Yeah.
So Mark Gatiss said that he got to go to meet Nigel Neal because they were looking to do a version of The Road for BBC Four.
And he
said that he just took the opportunity to ask him all the questions he possibly could about everything. And he was like saying about why did he do sort of just go on to do adaptations towards the end rather than writing his own stuff. And it was kind of implied that no one was interested in it. And then Mark Gatiss was basically talking to BBC Four and said, look, well, we asked him to do The Road, but you know, why don't we just ask them to write something new? And apparently someone high up at the BBC said, we don't work with anyone who predate the remote control. So it was just basically... But then apparently just before he left, he said, I did write another Quasimash, you know. and he goes, really? and he said, it was the Quasimass in the Second World War, the sort of the precursor which we talked about previously. Apparently there were Valkyrie monsters in it. But then was ever seen the document. So they don't know if he said he wrote it, but because he told Kim Newman the same thing, apparently.
Yeah.
But it was a case of no one's actually found the script, but he said he wrote it. So
amazing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Cool. So that was that then.
Jolly good.
Oh, it's a good one to come back to.
I think so, yeah. Very, very wholesome.
Okay, so next time on the Channel Witch Event, we're going to be watching, and we did mention Sherlock Holmes right at the beginning of this, we're going to be watching Murder by Decree.
Ooh.
Are we?
Yeah.
What is that? I don't even know what it is.
It's Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper with, who is Georg von Trapp?
Christopher Plummer?
Christopher Plummer is Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so
who directed this, Cleves? I have heard of it, I think, now, actually. It's not Billy Wilder, is it?
Mirror look. Kind of gives away. It's 1979 with Christopher Plummer as Holmes and James Mason as Watson.
Yeah, wow. It's not Billy Wilder.
Though. And that's it was directed by Bob Clark. Who also, Bob Clark was born in 1959, was director and writer known for A Christmas Story, Baby Geniuses and Porky's.
Yes! This is going to be the one. Porky's one of those films I've never seen all the way through. It's always on at like ITV at weird times.
I seen like a bit of. I got a memory of someone looking through a hole at some women getting changed.
That's you yourself. I've got a memory of myself looking through a hole. I mean,
yeah. So yeah, we're going to watch that.
Okay, brilliant. Is that a horror film?
Is it British? It's British, I think.
It's another one that our beloved listener is forcing us to listen to.
I put a thing I was saying, is there a Sherlock Holmes horror film? And we had a couple, and this is one of the ones which people were saying.
Was this made in Britain, Cleves?
So we're like,
me and John desperately trying to find ways out of this one.
I mean, if the guy directed Porky's, that doesn't sound very British.
Filming location, Oakley Court, Windsor Road, Oakley Green, Berkshire. Countries of origin, United Kingdom and Canada. Yeah, so it's a British-Canadian co-production.
It's a co-production.
Yeah, with the Canadian Film Development Corporation.
Well, I believe it when I see it.
Yeah, and it's got, who else has it got in it? Christopher Plummer, James Mason, David Hemmings, Susan Clarke, Anthony Quayle, John Gielgud, Frank Finlay, Donald Sutherland.
Wow.
God. Yeah. They'd all turn up for any old crap, wouldn't they?
How did Big Chris Lee not get in on this one?
£10,000 in a brown envelope.
June Brown's in it.
Amazing.
Okay.
Oh, just the very one last quick one. I'm regretting it already, and I think I might have to go buy it back and buy it in the week. I was looking in a charity shop yesterday, and they had Edward Woodward's album.
I got it.
He's got it. Look at that. I stopped and thought, should I get this? Yeah. It was like £3.
Yeah,
I thought, no, come on. And then, of course, as always, the way with things in charity shops, you immediately go afterwards. Oh, I should have got it. I own it.
You can borrow it.
Is it just one with the picture of his head in the middle, Ross?
I'll go and get it once.
The Edward Woodward album. Here we go.
Is it called the Edward Woodward album?
Woodward album.
Does he sing hits from the Wicker Man?
You hope so, don't you? Or it just does the theme from The Equalizer.
Awa Woowa.
Yeah. If I angle that.
Oh, look at that. Oh, look at that.
The light's not good.
It's headshot.
Yeah. Just says the Edward Woodward album.
I can't imagine a huge call for that.
I mean, neither, but, you know. That and a lot of James Last albums.
So many people made albums in the past, didn't they, that were just tenuous people that were pulled into...
I wonder how much of it was due to the success of Richard Harris's album, A Tramp Shining. Yes. What a title.
Well, I nearly bought
MacArthur
the one.
Park.
Yeah, well, that was a number one, I think.
It was?
Because I nearly bought one recently that was the guy from It Ain't Half Hot Mum that had a series of albums. But this
Don
was Estelle. Signed. Don Estelle. This was a signed Don Estelle. But I think it was a tenor, and I was like, oh, I don't know. This is
Come on. Yeah. There's a point where it's like the ironic comedy. It's like,
yes.
It's worth a tenor of ironic
and
comedy.
And a tenor.
Oh, can't find it. But I will get it for the next time.
Get it for next time.
I might go and buy it in the week.
No, it didn't have a...
snaffled up.
It was like a black sort of like leather thing just with Edward Woodward on it, and then inside it had pictures of him different like character sort of like
this is different to hats and saw, stuff Ross. On there. Yeah. Anyway, I brought that to field.
That's a good album title.
Yeah. The Different House of John Pountney. Okay. Well, lovely we speaking are. To you guys.
Well done, everyone.
Okay.
Cool. Thank you for waiting, everybody.
Right. Love, light, and
great
peace.
Great to be back.
Oh, yeah. What do I say?
Until next time.
Happy day. Bye.
See you soon, bye. all one of you.
You have been listening to The General Witchfinder. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell. You don't have nightmares.
Screenwriter Nigel Neal made in... So Ross, that doesn't read quite right. With Sorry. Some of the slight changes screenwriter made in the adaptation by... So anyway.
Leave it in, it's fine. Everyone gets... you can just read this bit on Wikipedia, guys. The Weaver's lifted verbatim.
No!
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.